It is June the 22nd, 2011. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. And as always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us an email at thisshowissogay@aol.com, strolling on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn more about the show. And as always, troll on over to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Jam-packed show for you tonight. Two guests on this lovely, kind of rainy Wednesday night. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I am.
Oh, this is a good thing. Let me introduce you. Dr. Frankie Bashan is the premier lesbian matchmaker of San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, and Brattleboro, Vermont, because I just decided that right now. So that's a resume builder, Frankie.
Good to know.
Okay, just put it on there. Her matchmaking service, Little Gay Book LLC, is the place not just to find a mate, but also to learn about yourself in the process. She holds a doctorate in the field of psychology, is an expert in the field of human behavior and matching, and is here to tell us how our gay radio show can find love with another gay radio show. Dr. Frankie Bashan, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me.
How's the weather out there?
It's actually really beautiful today.
Okay, nice talking to you.
It's fine. Sorry about that. You deserve a little sunshine.
Yes, please. I'll take it. All right, so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I am. Let's hear it.
All right. So let's go back to the early days. So pre-PsyD, when you were a little tyke Frankie, were there behaviors that you were evidencing that made it clear, oh yeah, she's totally going to be a matchmaker? Were you setting up stuffed animals? What was going on in your childhood?
What a great question. Yes, exactly. This has been my calling. So early on, I've always really, really been social and really wanting to bring people together, great people together. And early on when I was 13, I had an eye doctor who I knew my father would find to be very impressive. And he was single at the time, and I had introduced him to her with every intention of bringing them together. And they've been married 25 years now, and they have 3 kids. So that just gives you an idea.
My gosh.
Crazy nature.
I love that story.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Now, word on the street is that you are just the eternal optimist. Is that true?
I am very optimistic, yes.
How does that work out for you?
It serves me very well, and I think it will serve everybody very well. I think it's important to be positive and to sort of create a really just positive energy around yourself, and you bring positive people towards you, and good things happen in life when you stay positive. So I definitely am somebody who's very supportive of people kind of really focusing on being positive and recognizing there are absolutely negatives, but not emphasizing on them.
Okay. We can pull that off. We can all pull that off.
I believe you can. It just takes some effort and maybe, you know, some practice.
Okay.
Everybody's capable of doing it.
Now, I would never dream in years of doing this show, I would never dream of outing a guest's age. So I will not out your age. If you wanted to, you could do that.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. Would it help me? Would it benefit me?
Well, this is what's so interesting to me, because I do watch, okay, so I'm kind of a fan of The Millionaire Matchmaker and some of the other matchmaking shows, and I think that a lot of the matchmaking business is built on someone saying, I have decades and decades and decades of experience, and I'm in my 60s and 70s, and I know this inside and out. And what I love that you bring to the table is that, nope, you're not. Is it fair for me to tell everyone that you are not in your 60s?
No, I'm not. I'm actually 34.
Yes. You and I are both these 34 New Jersey, correct?
Manhattan.
So close.
But I'll give you that. Okay, a little close. Over the bridge.
Yeah. I'll take it. I tell people Manhattan, so it works. So you know, we are of the same age, and I would think that you would encounter some obstacles in establishing yourself at 34 in this particular business.
You know, I have a lot of experience. I started grad school in 2001, and I graduated in 2005. And I've practiced with couples for nearly a decade now. And I also have been in a relationship for 8.5 years with my partner, and we have 2 6-year-olds. I have twins, a girl twins. So I have personal experience of being in a long-term relationship, and I have about 10 years experience working in psychology, as a clinical psychologist, working with couples and individuals and children and families. So I am younger, but I'm somebody who has always been really driven, motivated, and focused. And I was one of the youngest in my cohort in graduate school. I think there were maybe three others around my age, but out of the 52 students, it's a significant age difference. So, yes, I think age, I think it could be a factor, but when you hear my background and my experience, I think hopefully people will sort of notice that and take that into consideration.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, I have no problem saying I have absolutely struggled. Gosh, your whole story is just so similar to mine. And again, as we've established, we're both from Manhattan. I'm just rewriting the story now. That's what I'm going to do. But it's definitely been difficult, especially, I have to say, the younger that you achieve a doctorate, people think that's a cool thing, but it actually, there are some walls that you run into when you are of an age that you have a doctorate, and people are like, but then you couldn't possibly have the experience. But you have the experience.
Yes, and I do notice a difference in the way that my clients react to me or respond to my recommendations today versus when I was, 25.
Absolutely.
There's a level of credibility and respect that I get now that I didn't get initially.
Yeah.
I
totally understand that. I totally understand that. All right, so what is preventing people from finding love? What do you find that your clients most need to work on?
I would say unrealistic expectations.
Hmm.
I think people are looking for perfection. And there really isn't perfection in terms of human behavior. I mean, we all have our flaws, and it's important to recognize what our flaws are and to also recognize that just because we have flaws, it doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of strength. And so I think what happens is people are looking for somebody perfect, a perfect mate, and they come up with a list of must-haves, non-negotiables, I call them, that really keep them single. Being, sort of alone and single. So I do a lot of work with my clients about being realistic, and I think it's important to have a couple deal breakers, but you don't want to have so many that it actually cripples you and your ability to find somebody.
But what about that flip side, about deal breakers? Because as you just said, you don't want to go so far, though, that you're saying, well, wait, this, I can't deal with this. This compromises my own integrity. How do you sort out that list of, well, this is what I can accept, this is what I cannot?
No, I'll give you an example just for myself.
Please.
A deal breaker for me would be somebody who isn't comfortable communicating. It's really important for me to communicate with my partner and for somebody to be non-defensive when I do communicate, and for somebody to be sort of passionate in life about something that they're doing. It doesn't have to be about their profession. Those are three deal breakers, right? Somebody who's unable, to communicate, somebody who doesn't have passion. So I feel like three is reasonable, I could come up with many more things that sort of bother me, like laziness, but as long as somebody is willing to make the effort, and that's sort of workable for me, that's not a deal breaker. So I think people just need to think about what's most important to them. Just pick one or, one to three, and I would say that's kind of enough.
Okay. Now, you've been doing this relationship column for Curve Magazine, providing advice for the masses, which is kind of interesting just because it's not, I would assume, the one-on-one work that you are more used to. You're getting these letters, and not only are you responding to the person writing the letter, but you're also responding to a heck of a lot more people than that who may have the same question. What is that experience like for you?
I really, really enjoy it because I'm able to reach a bigger audience. And I think that people bring up questions that are, they resonate for a lot of people. And I feel like it's nice to see people putting, sort of their pain out there and opening themselves up so that other people can learn from them. So I really enjoy being a part of that.
Well, let's put you on the spot and get to some of these questions. And see, I don't even want to read the narrative. I just love the headlines of the questions because I think that says it all. Dr. Frankie Bashan, how do I get over her?
And that's another thing, actually. It's like sometimes the questions are a bit vague, right? So it's like you don't have all the pieces to the story.
Right.
So I'm trying to give suggestions based on not a lot of information. So oftentimes I think to myself, I hope that I'm actually responding and answering this question that this person is posing, that they're presenting. So How do I get over it? How do I move on? Mm-hmm. Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important, you know, to recognize sort of what happened, why the relationship failed, right? We have to sort of make sense of what went wrong in order to move forward. And I think it's important to recognize maybe what you would look for in the future and a future partner, what you would want to see different. And then focus on yourself, focus on self-care. You know, how can you improve yourself? Can you, you know, engage with people who are more supportive? Can you engage in physical activity more? Can you be healthier, you know, emotionally, physically, mm-hmm. that sort of thing? Because it helps you, you know, I mean, I'm sure many people can relate to the feeling of going through a breakup and just feeling pretty icky about yourself yeah. and thinking, well, this is a catalyst. This is a motivator to start taking care of myself. And then they just get back, you know, onto their exercise regimen and start eating a healthier diet and that sort of thing. And it fuels self-esteem. And give yourself time. This is something I really emphasize, is that people jump in too quickly. You know, if you were in a year-long relationship, give yourself 6 months to a year to just kind of recover and figure out what went wrong, what went right, and find yourself again and feel good about who you are before you step out there. Because you want to make a good decision this next time. You want to kind of, you know, be more mindful about the choices that you make. And if you jump in too soon, you may be making a choice based on, you know, pain. You know what I mean? Choice, right. Sort of not being very clear about why you're making those choices.
But is there a light bulb moment? Because I certainly have fears, you know, coming out of a 9.5-year relationship. I don't know if there's going to be this light bulb moment of, oh, okay, yeah, no, now I'm ready.
You know, there often isn't a light bulb moment. I think sort of through trial and error do you realize that you're ready to get out there. You know, I think taking a few months to, you know, a 9.5-year relationship, I think is, you know, it's very significant, and I think it takes longer than a couple of months to recover. But it also depends on how long you've sort of been unhappy in right. your relationship. Could be that you've been unhappy for 2 years and you've sort of been disengaging and disconnecting, and now that you're actually broken up, you have this freedom to actually, you know, maybe get out there because you've already sort of worked through the letting go and mourning the loss of the relationship. So it really depends, but I do think we need to give ourselves time. And the way to tell if you're actually really ready to start dating again is to go out on a date and see if you can stay present. See if you're distracted. See if you're, you know, busy comparing, you know, your past partner to this current person that's sitting in front of you. And, you know, are you thinking about surfing tomorrow or the work that you didn't finish today? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't stay present. You're probably not ready.
I'm so getting billed for this hour. All right. I'll tell you where to send it later, but that's okay. Now, I want to talk about a population that doesn't often come up in these questions, and I think it's a pretty important one. What advice do you have for friends of the couple, friends who are either seeing things going downhill or maybe unfortunately have seen the breakup happen? But, you know, you have the friends who are friends with both of them, and what advice do you have for them in how to handle that?
I think it's really important to stay as neutral as possible, and I think that can be really hard depending on, you know, people's boundaries. So it could be that one person in the couple is sort of pulling the friend into on their side and sort of pulling them in that direction and not forcing them, but encouraging them to take a side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to maintain neutrality and as a friend just say, look, I'm here. I care about you. I love you. And I care about you both. And I just want to be, I want to be friends with you both. And the only way for me to do that is if I stay really neutral. But I'm here to support you. I know you're struggling, and I want you to be able to talk to me. But it can't, it may be that that person, that friend can't be the friend that you're going to badmouth your partner about because it is a friend that you share.
Yeah.
So you might have to pick a friend that you don't necessarily share to really express your anger or your resentment to and try to respect that this other friend is somebody who, you know, really cares about your partner, and it's only fair to respect them and not put them in a bad position.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, a lot of the questions that I was reading out there in that World Wide Web were all about a relationship's demise and the relationship's problems, and I thought we needed some happier questions, so I wrote a couple happier questions for you, okay? for great. Some happy crisis to resolve. So, Dr. Frankie Bashan, my relationship is the best thing that has ever happened to me. What do I do?
You just jump for joy. That's amazing. That's great. Aside from being really excited about being really satisfied in your relationship, I say maintain a separate identity. You know, continue, you know, your relationships that you had before you met your partner. You want to nurture those relationships. Don't let them fall to the side. Continue engaging in hobbies that you enjoy. Maybe find a hobby that you were, you know, considering but never were able to engage in, and encourage your partner to engage in it as well. You want to just kind of maintain some separateness, you know, within your own interests. You can include your partner in it, and it helps to do that, but I think you also need to maintain some of your own identity, because oftentimes I hear how couples merge and they sort of lose themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that, you know, one feels really so excited about the fact that they have found their soulmate or found the most compatible person ever. But also it's important to be realistic that you've got to maintain a sense of your own self.
You just turned my happy question into they have something to work on. That was you were just supposed to say great.
You know what? Always work. Ken, it's always work. Relationships work, but it should feel like good work. It should feel like you're investing in something really great. It shouldn't feel sort of like a drag. It should just feel like this is worth it. This is worth the investment of my time and my emotions and my energy.
Because I had this whole other one. I had this whole other one. Dr. Frankie, I go to work and I'm able to do my job in a stellar way and still look forward to seeing my partner, because tonight we're going to name our twin girls we're having next week. Help.
So, I mean, again, it's fantastic. And I love to hear those stories. And I never really do. People don't write in with those kinds of questions or, you know, I mean, I would say that remember also to do maintenance on your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you're in a honeymoon phase for 2-3 years, which is fantastic, you know, just don't rule out the possibility that you could have a little tune-up here and there.
Okay.
So don't wait until things are really bad to get help. Find somebody when things are pretty good, but there are some things that sort of are not, like, nagging at you. Find a therapist that you can connect with both as a couple. So that you have that person there when you hit rough waters, because it's inevitable. And again, I don't mean to be a downer. I just want to be really realistic.
So now all I'm thinking about now, I'll be very honest with you, because, you know, I'm lying on the couch and we're chatting, is your twin girls will be dating in, let's give them 15 years. A boy and a girl. They'll be allowed to date in what, 15 years?
Allowed to date in 15 years.
When they're 21, they can start dating.
Maybe a little younger. I feel like I'm a pretty progressive parent.
Now, what? I'm trying to figure out, sitting here right now, if I would want you for a mom or not, as I brought a date home.
Oh, wow. I haven't really thought about that.
See, you're going to have to think about this.
What I do often think about is being a psychologist and thinking, oh my gosh, my poor kids. I'm a psychologist and my partner's a police officer.
They're
in trouble. Big trouble. You know, I think that
it's not them. It's their date that is in such trouble.
Oh yeah, that's for sure.
That's hilarious.
You know, I have really mastered the practice of sort of not, as a therapist, you really need to be non-judgmental and maintain a really open mind, because you see a lot, and it's important not to be critical or judgmental of your clients, because that's not going to be helpful.
Right.
So I feel like I hope that that skill will carry over to my parenting, or I hope that it does carry over. So, yeah, I mean, I want the best for my kids, and obviously I want them to date good people. But I also know that, you know, if this person makes them happy, and it may not necessarily be somebody that I think they should be with, I need to figure out how to accept that. So I might need to go to therapy myself to learn how to deal with that. But you know what, Ken? I can't think that far ahead. That's giving me stress right now.
I'm sorry. I hate when my gay radio show causes the guest stress. So to de-stress, because what a great way to de-stress, we have to talk about your musical selections for this evening. Now, I do believe that you are the first PsyD we've had on this program in our 3-year existence. So this is the part of the show where you, Dr. Frankie Bashan, get to psychoanalyze yourself based on your song selections. So I'm going to give these two songs that you've requested that we're playing tonight, and you are going to tell our listening audience what these songs say about Dr. Frankie Bashan. Are you ready?
Okay, yeah.
What does Adele's Set Fire to the Rain say about Dr. Frankie?
Passion. She's very passionate. She's somebody who speaks her feelings in such a magical way, and it just resonates for me because I feel like there's this, she talks a lot about relationships and just the feelings around different relationships, and for me, it's just magical how she turns all of these emotions into such amazing music. So I enjoy Adele. I feel that she has a lot of passion, and I feel like I have a lot of passion, and I just feel really inspired by her and her lyrics.
Nice. Now, this next one, I think, is going to be more of a metaphor. It might be more of a metaphor. What does Frank Sinatra's New York, New York say about Dr. Frankie?
Okay, wow. So growing up, I listened to a lot of Frank Sinatra because my father absolutely adores him. But more recently, my kids had their kindergarten graduation, and
nice.
New York, New York was their song. So they wanted me to purchase the song, and we would drive every day to and from school. We would be singing New York, New York, Frank Sinatra. So it's been on my mind, and it's something I heard as a child, and I'm from Manhattan, and I love New York. It's my city, even though now I'm in the Bay Area. But it's just, so that's it. So it's a song that really is very personal to me, and my kids are now actually singing it, which is wonderful.
Nice. That was so my childhood as well. I really need to start telling people I'm from Manhattan, and then we can really be twins, and it'll be great. Now, what's coming up for you? What should we know about?
What's coming up for me? So, I'm continuing to do a lot of coaching. I'm actually available to do coaching internationally now, so I can do it via Skype or phone. So aside from matchmaking, I do a lot of coaching. But that's been what I've been emphasizing and focusing on. I'm thinking also there are two other matchmakers that I work with, and friends with, who we're starting to write a book. And it will be a book about how to be effective at dating and how to develop a healthy relationship and a solid foundation from the, experience of 3 matchmakers.
Awesome. And what website can you direct us to that we can learn more about all the cool things that you're doing?
www.littledatebook.com.
Love it. And I probably should have kicked off with this question. Do you feel it's different work for someone in your profession to be working with the gay community as opposed to the heterosexual community?
I think it's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, in the gay community, we have less role models, right? So I think a lot of what I do is instill inspiration and knowledge and education into my clients. I think that a lot of us have been led to believe that, we're not capable of having healthy relationships and that it's not okay for us to have children and that sort of thing. So I think that there's a lot of internalized homophobia, which is a whole other segment.
Right.
So it's a lot of, it's a lot of education and a lot of inspiration that I try to just let them know that they're capable, that just because society for all these years has been, oppressing us and rejecting us and stigmatizing us, discriminating against us, doesn't mean that we're not capable. So
right.
It's different. It definitely is different, I think.
Yeah. I could not be more appreciative of the work that you are doing. This is important work. And my gosh, are you just a great ally for healthy relationships. This is a good thing.
Thank you, Ken. And thank you so much for inviting me onto your show. And you do amazing work, too. Look, you've invited me on. I've been able to share all of this information with your viewers, and I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, keep doing good things, and all my best to the little ones.
Thanks so much.
All the best.
Take care. Same to you.
Bye.
I let it fall.
right, and we are back. And just like that, we're ready to welcome another guest. Hey, other guest, are you ready to be welcomed?
I am.
Fantastic. Let me introduce you. Originally from Austria, now living in New York, filmmaker Susie Graf is producing content that we all need to see. She has received Fulbright scholarships and prestigious grants for her work. She has worked as a TV producer, interviewing various A-listers such as Quentin Tarantino, Demi Moore, Bruce Willis, Michael Douglas, Mel Gibson. And she recently finished producing and directing the documentary Lost in the Crowd. That's Lost in the Crowd, which is focused on LGBT homeless youth in New York City. Susie Graf, welcome to this show with So Gay.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm really well. I'm here in New York, and it's extremely humid.
Yes, well, that's New York. I'll be there tomorrow, Susie. I'm very excited. Well, it begs the first question, Susie. Mm-hmm. Vienna versus New York. Who wins? who wins in that fight?
I've been here for 20 years, so I guess New York.
Good. That is the correct answer, Susie. That is the correct answer. No, but for folks who've never been to Vienna, what good things can you say on behalf of the Vienna Tourism Board?
Oh, there's lots of good things to say. For instance, there's balls. For instance, the opera ball. And that is a fantastic event where people dance in elegant robes to orchestral music, and that's the society event of the year. But I have discovered something in New York that's a ball, too. And that's the underground voguing balls. And that, to me, is much more exciting.
Wow. Anything that has the first name of underground is usually pretty exciting.
Yeah.
That's
pretty exciting.
Good stuff. Well, before we talk about the film, mm-hmm. let's talk about a little bit about your interviewing background, because as I said in your intro, you've been involved in a ton of really A-list celebrity interviews. What do you think, as you are sitting on the other side of the interview, what do you think is the key to getting something different out of someone who's being interviewed over and over again?
I think in human communication, there's only one thing, and that is connection. If we connect to the other person is always going to say something real. And that's an art. It's a skill to connect to another person in every situation in life. And if you can do that, then you will also have always have a truthful connection, and that is love between people.
Nice. Oh, Susie, I want us to have a connection now.
Yes.
This would be good. So if I say something like, Susie, I always like the glasses that you wear, does mm-hmm. that help us on the road to that connection?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Because I do. You always have pictures with good glasses on. I'm just saying. All right, now
yes.
We have a lot to talk about with this movie. We have a lot to talk mm-hmm. about with this movie. So let's go back, and I know it's a while back, because we're going to talk about how long you've worked on this. But starting from the beginning, how did you come to immerse yourself in Lost in the Crowd?
I came to it, it chose me. I didn't really have any idea about anything LGBT before I made this project. Mm. And I made a fundraising video for underprivileged kids for an organization here in the city. And so it was about literacy programs and school lunches and stuff like that. And they needed that for one of those fundraisers. Mm-hmm. And so they sent me here and there, and I went with my team and we filmed. And then they said, well, we have one more little activity. In the night, we go around with a bus. Would you mind to go there for a couple of hours and just film that too? And I said, okay, sure. And that's how it started. Then we went with this bus to Hunts Point, which some of the listeners may be familiar with from those prostitution shows on HBO. And now it's pretty much gentrified, and there's a market there, and, it's more decent now. But at the time, it was one of the worst areas in the city, and there was just a lot of prostitution and crack and child prostitution and mother-daughter prostitution mm-hmm. and all sorts of awful things. And I was just so shocked because I come from rather sheltered situations, as I have learned. I didn't know that before. And I just saw kids in the winter with short sleeves and no food and trying to find a place for them to stay for the night. And I got so upset that I said I have to make a film about that. And at the time, I didn't even know that these were LGBT kids. That's something I learned with time. Mm. And so that's how it happened.
Wow. Now, a lot of, gosh, Susie, every media piece that I've seen about the film highlights how long you worked on this piece. And you know, where, oh, it's 7 years, it's 8 years, 6 years, you know, however long. But I would imagine that lumping all of those years together would really be simplifying things more than a, you know, more than a bit. Can you talk a little bit about the highs and the lows of being involved, of sustaining yourself in a project for that long?
Well, with documentaries, it's not that unusual, because if you follow people for a while, then you have to invest this time. And I think the most famous example is that documentary that filmed people every 7 years.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
they were 7 and 14 and 21 and then 49. And that is a real big time investment. So compared to that, my 8 years aren't so bad. And some documentaries have 1,000 hours or even more. So documentaries in general are labors of love. And it's that wish to get the true essence of the situation and not make a news piece or an information piece or some, you know, balanced piece with two people say something positive and two people say something negative, and then you slap in a couple of what we call B-roll and music and titles, and that's it. So a documentary is something else. It's almost like a dissertation or a research project. You have some sort of question or mission, and then you try to find out what's really going on. Because if you just have already some opinion, then it becomes propaganda, and nobody's really interested in seeing that. So it was for me something very new, and still is new. And I discovered a new world. And for me, this has always been the most inspiring thing, if in a city like New York really lends itself to that sort of procedure. It is when you are, for instance, in a subway and you fall asleep or you start daydreaming or you just think of something else and go on your iPhone or whatever, and then you get out at some stop and you don't know where you are and you've never seen this station name before, and you go up the stairs and you're somewhere completely different in a strange territory, which has happened to me in New York often. And I'm thinking, this is my hometown and I've lived here for 20 years and I don't pay attention for 5 minutes and I find myself in a strange land, in a bizarre land where I enter at my own risk and I recognize nothing. I mean, I'm exaggerating here for entertainment purposes, but it is a little bit like that. And with this film, it was like that. I saw that I'm on familiar turf within the city, and then suddenly I found this whole culture. Some people call it subculture, I call it culture. And I had no idea it existed. And so I was trying to come from my very straight point of view, because I'm a single mother and I have, you know, not that much knowledge about all the things that I learned about two-spirited and, you know, all these things that I was not familiar with and that I learned with this documentary. I learned so much about sexuality and the complexity of human beings. And I'm so grateful I could participate in that, because I think it changed me as a person, and I have a totally different circle of friends now than before.
Wow.
I upgraded my friends.
Yeah, I love that. And then we get to talk, so that's an upgrade too.
Yes.
Now, was there a moment where you said, oh, okay, we are done. We have now shot our last shot. How do you know, especially when you've been filming for 8 years, how do you know when you have enough?
When you're broke and you have a nervous breakdown.
Okay. I have now learned about your craft. That's so funny. No, really. I mean, I would imagine that's part of it, too, of like, you know what? I'm good. We have enough.
Yeah. Well, it's never over. My main character is in jail, and because of my website, lostinthecrowd.net, the biological mother found the kid after 25 years, and there was the big reunion in jail. So the mother came from Hawaii and reunited with Kimmy in an upstate security correctional facility. And it was so bittersweet. It was so epic to see this reunion between a child and a mother after all this time. And there are so many rewarding moments, and this was one of the major ones, because I really changed something in a family because of the website.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this possibility to change things. All of us have this possibility, and I think that's the beauty of being human and being here and just do little things, because big things we usually can't do, but we can try.
Yeah, I maybe want to be – I'm going to be a little challenging because, you know, you're a former Austrian and you live in New York, and I know you can – and I know you can take it.
Yes, okay.
So yes, a documentary is supposed to do just that, document. But I would imagine that there are many people out there who will say, you have made a documentary about LGBT youth. I don't even care what's in it. That is propaganda. That they will immediately see this as, there's no way that you are just documenting. You are trying to get people to see a certain thing and change opinions.
Yes, of course. It's always like that, because there is no objectiveness in film. Never, ever. Because you take a camera and you point it at something, and the way you point it at something, you choose a frame and you choose a shot size. And as we all know, it has a big psychological impact if we show someone close up or from far away, or if we look down on someone, or if we look up at someone. So all these choices are very subjective. And you can only explore a subject matter, and then people have to make up their own mind, because I don't have any answers. I don't make propaganda because I don't know the answers. If I would say, this is the way or that is the way, and this means this and this means that, that would be propaganda. And sometimes that happens when religious organizations make films or political parties make films.
Mm-hmm.
Then they come from a very clear perspective. But in a documentary where you try to ask questions, that's basically what you're doing, and let people speak for themselves, that is not propaganda unless it's done very badly.
Yeah. And we've seen that too, though, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, sometimes it's good.
Sometimes it's good, yeah.
Some people can do it, and they have such entertainment value, and it's okay too if it's a little bit with a grain of salt, if it's funny or if it's shocking or if there's some value to it, then people can get away with it. But in general, if it's an intelligent documentary, people want different perspectives, and they want some deeper level. And I think that's what's necessary to make a good documentary. And that's why they take a long time, because first of all, it takes time for people to open up, and then it takes time to go through life. Because as we all know, everything is changing all the time.
Right.
And so then things emerge and everybody knows more about everything, and that that can be felt in the movie. And then afterwards, suddenly you see some connections that you just could not see at the beginning.
Right.
And that is the interesting part.
Now, what do you want for this movie?
Well, I don't really want anything. I have done this. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, that it would take so long. But now it's done, and I have hopes that it will be on the educational circuit. So all these universities and schools, they have programs mm-hmm. for harm prevention. And, for instance, here in New York, there was this whole series of suicides because of LGBT bullying, and kids died. They, you know, committed suicide, and nobody wants that. And so many organizations and many schools make this now part of their education to try to prevent that. And I hope that my film will be an educational tool, and that, you know, it will be helpful to maybe help generations, parents and children, to get along. Because I interviewed also parents, and some of them are really very religiously indoctrinated, and others are very free and supportive. And I think if children and parents can see this and talk about it, then it's already great.
Yeah.
It's just bad if people turn away and say, I never want to see you again, and go away, and never again. That, I think, is really bad. Fighting and discussing and all those things, that's good.
Can I add one more group? I really want to throw the teachers on there as just one mm-hmm. of the top groups that needs to see this film.
Yeah.
The teachers who are there from year to year, who really can have some of the biggest impact. I think that is and who are receiving so little training in how
yeah.
to work with these issues. They yeah, need to see it.
Mm-hmm. What I've learned is, you know, I could not understand why parents would throw their children out. To me, that is so foreign, to think that someone would send their child on the street just because of a sexual orientation. To me, that doesn't make any sense. But when you talk to the parents and you realize how inept they are to deal with a situation like that,
right.
because they have such fear and they are so ignorant and they are psychologically so threatened that
right.
the only thing they can do is get rid of that danger. And that is so sad, and that can be avoided so easily by talking about it and not, you know, allowing a taboo to overwhelm everybody. And much can be done with very little. That's what I learned, because as I said at the beginning, if you have a connection and you feel someone, they will be grateful. Everybody wants attention. Everybody wants to be seen as who they are. And these kids, they are like everybody else's kids. There's, you know,
yeah.
no reason to exclude them. And when I went to these balls and I saw how much they try to celebrate the community and create something that is theirs, I really learned how they struggle, because here in New York, and I'm sure in L.A., it's the same thing. There's so many people, and they have this dream of who they want to be,
yeah.
and then the reality is very different, and they have to make a living that is very different from who they think they are or who they want to be. And it's such a challenge to make this work, to say, I'm an artist, but I also have to feed myself, or I'm an activist, but I also have to take care of my sick mother, or whatever the challenges of life are. And to take this on and to make it work, it's so much harder for young people who have no education and no resources, economical or in terms of support, of parents or any sort of mentor, and these obstacles, they are almost too much. And then, of course, these kids, end up in prostitution and drugs and crime because there's nothing else there for them.
There's nothing there.
And
yeah.
It's almost unavoidable. What can you do when you're hungry and when you don't have a roof over your head? There's not that many opportunities. And many of them don't have a privileged education and don't have anyone to go to. And so I think if we all think of what that's like, then, empathy is the only thing you can have for such a person.
I mean, I find that one of the easiest ways to avoid throwing your child out of the house because of their sexual orientation is to not throw them out of your house due to their mm-hmm. sexual orientation.
Exactly.
So, well, I want you to tell us 8,000 times where we can go to learn more about this film.
Well, it's the website, lostinthecrowd.net, of course. And we will have an official DVD release in, I believe, October. But I think that the DVD can be ordered online as well. And, if people would check out the website, then they see all sorts of related information. And, I just hope that we will keep talking about LGBT youth because they're not going away and they're more and more coming down the pipeline. It's summer now in New York and you see kids everywhere. Now that I know where to look, I just can tell you there are not fewer. And the interesting thing is also that when I started, that was before the economic meltdown.
Mm.
And the shelters that I show and the organization that help, they have decreased in the meantime. None of those places exists anymore. So when I started making that film, there was almost no help. And then the economic meltdown came, and then it's even less help
yeah.
now. So the conditions are even worse than what I show in the film.
Wow. Yeah.
So I think it's really good to...
Work to be done. There is work to mm-hmm. be done. Oh, and I have to ask you about one
yeah.
of your songs. My gosh,
yeah.
I almost left off the songs part. I'm only going to make you do one, Susie. Susie, as we
yeah.
just did with our previous guest, because this is one of the songs you requested, which we're going to play at the end of the show. Susie, why did you request You Are My Sister by Anthony and the Johnsons? What does that song say about filmmaker Susie Graf?
It is in my film, and Anthony has donated this song to the film, which is something he has never done before. That song cannot be heard in any other film. And the lyrics go, "You are my sister, and I love you, and I wish that all your dreams come true." And that is what I wish, and that is what I hope, and it's also a very beautiful song.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Susie, I'm not sure that I can think of something that would have more of a positive effect on this community, on the LGBT community, and indeed all of society, than you pointing your camera at an area of society that no one else is pointing their camera and giving voice to a community that currently does not have a voice. And I'm sure you know it, but I hope to God you know how huge that is and how important and vital this work is.
Thank you.
And the most important question, did we have a connection?
We have a connection.
Okay. Well, folks, you know where to go. We will post the link on our website. Susie, please keep pointing that camera where you know it needs to keep pointing. Please do.
I will.
All right. All the best, Susie.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You are my sister. We were born so innocent, so full of need. There were times we were friends, but times I was so cruel. Each night I'd ask for you to watch me as I sleep. I was so afraid of the night. You seemed to move through the places that I feared. You lived inside my world so softly, protected only by the kindness of your nature.
You are my sister, and I love you. May all of your dreams come true. You are my sister, and I love you.
So differently then, so similar over the years. The way we loved and the way we experienced pain. So many memories, there's nothing left to gain from remembering faces and worlds.
And that was Susie Graf, filmmaker. Please go check out that film, Lost in the Crowd, and we will have a link up on the website. And strangely and oddly and unbelievably, that brings us to the end of our show. Broadcasting this week, I should say, from WDTR Dead Tree Radio in the basement of a Marlboro College building, hosting us until WVEW gets back on the air in August, which we hope will be mighty, mighty soon. Hey, I want to let you guys know I'm doing a bike ride. Many of you know, you've been listening for years. I have been a roadie for the past 10 years on probably right around 10 rides, 3-day walks, and I'm taking the plunge, and I'm going to be a rider. I am doing Charity Treks, and it is a ride from Montreal to Portland, Maine. People are like, Portland, Oregon? That's really far. No. Portland, Maine, and it's August 9th through 13th, and I'm gonna actually be a bike rider, and I'm going to bike 445 miles in an effort to raise money to fight AIDS. All the funds raised go to the Emory Vaccine Center and the UCLA AIDS Institute. And so my target, my goal, is to get 500 people to donate $10. 500 people to donate $10. So if you are interested in forking over $10, I'm going to put it up on the homepage at thisshowisogay.com. And you can click on a link right there and donate your $10 and maybe tell someone else about it. So, as I said, go to thisshowisogay.com. Check out upcoming guests. We have fantastic people coming up next week. Just next week already. Gosh, how these weeks just go by quickly. We have Mr. Gay USA 2011, Michael Holtz. And on our homepage there, one of the only pictures of him with a shirt. We're going to ask him about the shirtless versus shirt ratio in his pictures. Stroll on over to iTunes, type in "This Show Is So Gay," subscribe to our podcast, and if you already have subscribed, go on over to iTunes and rate us. And by rate us, I mean 5 stars. We like 5 stars, and write a comment, and it helps expose more people to the show, and we always enjoy that. And yes, as always, go to the Facebook, type in "This Show Is So Gay," like us, we like you. And if you have a guest idea, we have great luck in getting them, so drop us an email at thisshowisogay.com. And that, my friends, wraps it up for here this week on This Show Is So Gay. Get out there. I was going to say go give some relationship advice, but maybe seek relationship advice from an expert. Maybe don't give it, because we have people like Dr. Frankie who actually, she knows what she's talking about. So seek relationship advice, work on your relationship, go do good things, point your camera at some area of society, whatever that camera may be. It's like a metaphor. Point that camera at some area of society that really needs light on it, because light is a good thing, and give voice to a community that does not have a voice. And the first person who needs that voice is you. So get out there, use your voice, try to make a difference, and of course, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Thank you.
start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you. New York, New York, New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that never sleeps and find I'm a number one, top of the list, king of the hill.